sedition laws. The Scottish martyrs were the first to be transported to New South Wales for crimes such as calling each other citizen. The non-violent martyrs advocating settling political differences over a nice cup of tea. They even offered to bring the biscuits. The colonial authorities viewed these original political prisoners as harmless eccentrics, allowing them to live in their own huts and exempting them from convict labour. The Irish, however, were an altogether different kettle of potatoes. The Irish were into violence in a big way, and the more sectarian the better. Ireland was riddled with not very secret societies whose members dressed distinctively in order to recognise each other. Unfortunately, this meant they were also recognised by the British authorities and members of the other secret societies that had sworn to eliminate them. In 1793, the Orange Boys, a militant Protestant organisation, split from the Peep of the Day Boys, a secret society dedicated to burning down Catholic farms. The Orange Boys, who wore orange collars when going out to beat up Catholics, grew up in 1796 to become the Orange Men. The Ribbon Men, a militant Catholic organisation, succeeded the Defenders, a secret society dedicated to burning down Protestant farms. The Ribbon Men wore green ribbons in their buttonholes when going out to beat up anyone wearing an orange collar. Sectarianism was briefly put aside when members of various Protestant and Catholic secret societies banded together with former members of the White Boys, an agrarian secret society whose members wandered about at night in bright white smocks, levelling ditches, setting fire to haystacks, and hamstringing cows on those Catholic and Protestant farms that had not yet been burnt down. Ireland had many other boy-themed secret societies, including the Green Boys, Oak Boys and Steel Boys. Boyzone is not an Irish secret society. This new inclusive society of United Irishmen, led by the charismatic Wolfe Tone, was a militant Republican organisation dedicated to burning down anything owned by Britain. It helps your revolutionary cred if you have a really cool name. Ernesto Guevara was known as Shay. Salazar changed his name to Pol Pot, and Viscerianovich Djugashvili purged anyone who didn't call him Joseph Stalin. Wolfe's real name was Theobald. The United Irishmen wore brown coats and a distinctive cropped hairstyle, which led to them being known as croppies. When the British authorities started arresting anyone with short hair, the croppies responded by capturing British loyalists, giving them a haircut and turning them loose, thinking this would sow confusion in Loyalist ranks. It just made them really mad. The Loyalists retaliated by pitch-capping croppies, conditioning their short locks with hot tar, waiting for the tar to cool, and then tearing it off, complete with hair and lumps of smouldering flesh. The United Irishmen did not like this new hair care regime, and, with the support of 1,000 elegantly coiffured French troops, launched the Irish Rebellion of 1798. The rebellion was an unmitigated disaster. Although laws limiting firearm ownership had been repealed 5 years earlier, the rebels preferred to fight the British with pikes. The pike was a long spear that had fallen out of military fashion 150 years earlier, but the Irish were traditionalists. It was also considered traditional, when marching against cannons and muskets armed with only a pointy bit of metal, to die a horrible, albeit quick, death. The British regiments and their Orange Men goon squads butchered anyone wearing a brown coat and quickly put down the rebellion. New South Wales awoke to an influx of rebels. Most of them wanted to put their past behind them, but the colonists wouldn't let them. They were Irish, ipso facto, they were bloodthirsty murderers dedicated to bringing republicanism and sectarian violence to New South Wales. Hunter described the Irish exiles as extremely insolent, refractory and turbulent. King called them satanic. And Marsden opined, "The low Irish convicts are an extraordinary race of beings whose minds are depraved beyond all conception and their whole thoughts employed on mischief." The fact that 80% of the Irish convicts spoke Gaelic and kept climbing into small wooden boxes with the colony's three convict priests, where they'd all jabber away in foreign speak, fueled the suspicion that they were plotting something. The colonists drew no distinction between Protestant and Catholic. They tarred all the Irish with the same brush and then, for good measure, feathered them with the same chicken. This drew Protestant and Catholic closer together at a time when sectarianism was splintering the united Irishman back in dear old Ayr. As historian Patrick O'Farrell put it, the colony's Irish banded together to defend themselves against the charge that they banded together. In 1800, one of the convict priests, Father Harold, informed Governor Hunter of a planned Irish uprising. Irish Republicans had been manufacturing pikes and planned to attack the church at Parramatta during Sunday service, when all the town's soldiers would be present and unarmed. Harold would not name the rebels, so Marsden decided to torture the information out of the colonists with the most Irish name. Paddy Galvin was illegally given 300 lashes to encourage him to reveal where the pikes were hidden, but said nothing, even when the bones of his back were laid bare. The rebel leader, Michael Quinlan, was eventually found drunk at dawn on the day of the planned attack, and the other rebels were rounded up and exiled to Norfolk Island along with Father Harold. In 1801, Britain dissolved the Irish Parliament and formally unified Ireland with Great Britain. The new Union Jack, bearing the cross of St Patrick, flew in New South Wales for the first time on 27 May 1801. The sound of pikes being sharpened carried on the Sydney breeze. In 1802, Irish plotters planned to drive captured English convicts into the guns of the Redcoats. Those who refused to die for the uprising would be shot by the Irishmen behind them. This revolution never took off, but back in Ireland, the united Irishmen had regrouped under Robert Emmet. Emmet was confident that this time his countrymen would defeat the British. Irish weapon scientists had just invented a terrible new device that would change the face of modern warfare forever. The folding pike. The folding pike was a hinged pike that folded in half, the Irish precursor to the flick knife. While this made the pike easier to conceal, the hinge tended to collapse when the pike was inserted into an Englishman. Unsurprisingly, Emmet's 1803 rebellion was a complete fizzer. The Irish love nothing more than heroic failure. It gives them an excuse to write melancholic poetry and gather in pubs to cry while singing tedious songs into their room temperature beers. Inspired by Emmet's brave ineptitude, the colony's Irish gathered themselves to fail, or die in the attempt, or both. On 4 March 1804, Philip Cunningham, a United Irish captain, led 220 predominantly Irish convicts from the Castle Hill work camp in an attack on the nearby government farm. The rebels, who had seized weapons from their overseers, planned to attack Parramatta, execute government officials and settlers, plant a tree of liberty at Government House, seize a ship, and bugger off back to Ireland. Things didn't go to plan. The rebels split up to ransack nearby farmsteads, where they seized more weapons and drank the farmers' rum. Two of the pissed raiding parties wandered about in circles in the dark and never made it to Parramatta. Convicts at the other settlements didn't get the message to join the uprising, but informers alerted Marsden and the Corps. When the rebels discovered Parramatta was defended, they milled about for a while and then marched back into the bush. The Corps was now led by George Johnson, who had been cleared at court-martial of illegally trading in spirits and returned to the colony and the now matronly arms of Esther Abrahams. King had declared martial law, and Johnston had authority to shoot anyone who so much as said, "Top of the morning." Unfortunately, he only had 29 troops and 67 members of a civilian militia, while Cunningham now had about 300 men. Johnston did what any good military leader would do when outnumbered by a horde of desperate Irishmen. He persuaded Cunningham and William Johnston, another senior rebel, to parley under a flag of truce. He then held pistols to their heads and ordered his men to fire on the suddenly leaderless Irish. The Irish, who by now should have been used to the English not playing fair, broke and ran. Quartermaster Laycock slashed Cunningham in the face with his sword and left him for dead. The bodies of the 15 rebels killed in the Battle of Vinegar Hill were left to rot where they lay. A local Irish landowner dubbed this skirmish the Battle of Vinegar Hill in 1826, naming it after the battle in the 1798 rebellion in which the Irish Republicans got their asses completely kicked. Many of the surrendered or captured survivors of Vinegar Hill Mark II were flogged within an inch of their lives and sent to establish the harsh new convict settlement of Newcastle, where they were forced to dig coal for their British masters. Cunningham survived his wound, but was hanged from the steps of the public store at Windsor the following day. Eight other rebel leaders were also publicly hanged, some in chains, their bodies left to swing at strategically selected places throughout the colony. A grim reminder to would-be rebels that the Empire would always strike back. Irish malcontents made a couple of half-hearted attempts to attack the colonists over the next 3 years, but their hearts weren't really in it. Vinegar Hill had quieted the calls for Irish freedom, and it would be another 50 years before the Irish would again rise up to be soundly thrashed at the Battle of Eureka Stockade. The People versus William Bligh. With the Irish put safely back in their box, one would have assumed that the storm clouds of rebellion had passed over the colony. But political forecasters hadn't factored in Cyclone Bligh. Britain wanted a strong man capable of finally pulling the corps into line, and Sir Joseph Banks recommended Bligh as firm in discipline, civil in deportment, and not subject to whimper and whine when severity of discipline is wanted. With Banks in his corner, Bligh got the gig. Bligh's wife mutinied and refused to travel to New South Wales, so Bligh took his 22-year-old daughter, Mary Putland, as Lady of Government House, and her consumptive husband, Lieutenant John Putland, as his aide-de-camp. Ellis Bent, a later judge advocate for the colony, leeringly described Mary as
very small, nice little figure, rather pretty but conceited and extremely affected and proud. God knows of what. Extremely violent and passionate, so much as now and then to fling a plate or candlestick at her father's head.
Bligh wanted to restore Philip's vision of a colony of smallholders, tending their turnip patches and taking turns to milk the communal goat. MacArthur, with his vast estates and deep pockets, was the living embodiment of everything Bligh publicly despised and secretly envied. Bligh put an end to the large pastoral grants that allowed MacArthur and his cronies to thrive. King had granted 60,000 acres during his rule. Bligh granted only 4,180 acres, 2,000 of which were to himself and his daughter. King had also backdated land grants to Bligh and Mary, which Bligh repaid by granting 790 acres to Mrs. King, which she rather indiscreetly named Thanks. Bligh mounted a concerted campaign to cripple MacArthur's various business ventures and ordered his prosecution for the illegal importation of stills. When MacArthur was refused an item from the government store, he wrote pointedly, "It would be better if he gave it to me and some of the other respectable gentlemen of the colony. If he does not, he will perhaps get another voyage in his launch again." MacArthur was not alone. John and Gregory Blaxland, Australia's first truly wealthy immigrants, also wanted to cast Bligh adrift. The British government had promised the brothers 8,000 acres and 80 convicts in return for investing £6,000 in New South Wales. Bligh gave them 1,290 acres and 23 convicts. Of the first three convicts provided, one was an old man with one eye and one arm, one was an aged asthmatic incapable of work, and one was an idiot. Bligh was not satisfied with alienating the pastoralists. He alienated the ex-convict traders when he jailed three of their most prominent members. He alienated workers when he imposed fixed wages, with any person asking for higher pay sent to the stocks or given 3 months' hard labour. He had already alienated the corps, calling his military bodyguards
tremendous buggers, wretches and villains,
and asking Britain to recall this
dangerous militia.
But Bligh's relationship with Johnston was irreversibly damaged when the corps humiliated his daughter. Mary had been causing a stir on Sydney's emergent fashion scene, as Mrs. Bligh outfitted her with the latest couture from London and Paris. The continent's it girls of spring-summer 1807 were all wearing French gauze, and Mary wasn't going to be seen in last season's dull linen. Europe's fashionistas also wore petticoats, which Mary deemed impractical for the colony's sweltering climate, instead preferring a pair of brief pantaloons. As Blind, his daughter, entered Sunday service, the harsh Australian sun illuminated Mary from behind, shining through her diaphanous gown and giving the colonial paparazzi their first celebrity rude bits moment. This is now referred to as doing a Britney, or if the display is for grotesque self-publicity, doing a Lindsay. The soldiers attending the service exploded with laughter. Mary fainted from mortification, and Bligh introduced Johnson and his men to his extensive vocabulary of four-letter words. But it was Bligh's cavalier approach to property that caused the most concern. Bligh ordered leaseholders to pull down their houses and vacate land adjoining Government House so that he might improve his view. While Bligh had refused the Blaxlands the convicts they had been promised, he found 80 spare ones to landscape his backyard. Bligh offered MacArthur compensation to quit land he had leased, but MacArthur refused and paid soldiers in wine to fence the land for him. Before they could begin, a government official arrived and informed MacArthur that he'd been ordered to take down any fence rails. MacArthur picked up a hammer and provocatively installed the first rail himself. When the fence was torn down and his fencing materials confiscated, MacArthur loudly denounced this and the earlier confiscation of his stills as government theft. No man's property was safe from the hypocritical dictator, he warned, an attack that resonated strongly with the colonists. Sydney people love real estate. It's all they talk about at dinner parties. And they were aghast at the thought that the government might seize their one-bedroom, no-bathroom hovel with double lock-up convict. Things came to a head in December 1807, when a convict escaped on one of MacArthur's trading ships. Bligh fined MacArthur, MacArthur refused to pay, and the ship was confiscated. MacArthur then refused to feed and pay the ship's crew, declaring that they were the governor's responsibility. Bligh now had a marauding band of starving sailors on his hands, and they were terrorising Sydney. He ordered a warrant for MacArthur's arrest on charges of unlawfully permitting his sailors to go ashore. MacArthur reminded Bligh that they were now his sailors and wrote of the warrant, "I consider it with scorn and contempt, as I do the persons who have directed it be executed." MacArthur was arrested and brought before the criminal court, which comprised six officers of the corps and Richard Atkins. The 25 January 1808 trial immediately degenerated into farce. MacArthur claimed that Atkins was prejudiced against him and owed him money and should therefore be removed from hearing the case. When the officers agreed with this argument, Atkins shouted that he would jail MacArthur. One of the officers retorted that he would jail Atkins. The soldiers who packed the public gallery cheered and Atkins scurried away to consult the governor. Bligh demanded that George Johnson come and bring his men into line. Johnston refused on the grounds that he'd been drunk the night before and had injured himself by rolling his carriage in Australia's first recorded drink-driving accident. MacArthur was jailed and Bligh threatened to charge the officers who refused to hear the case with inciting treason. Bligh had just declared open war on the corps. Johnson popped a barocca, travelled to the barracks and ordered his soldiers to spring MacArthur from prison. MacArthur, the Blaxlands and over 140 colonists signed a letter calling on Johnston to arrest the governor and assume command of the colony. On the evening of 26 January 1808, 20 years to the day after the colony was founded, George Johnston, the first European to set foot on Sydney's shores and the man who had put down the rebellion at Vinegar Hill, led 300 soldiers against Bligh in Australia's only military coup. There is now evidence that Bligh carried a mutiny gene. In 2012, the entire state of Queensland mutinied against Bligh's descendant, Premier Anna Bligh, giving her government the largest electoral defeat in Queensland's history. The rebellion against Bligh's rule is now known as the Rum Rebellion. Bligh attempted to characterise the coup against him as revenge for his efforts to curb the spirit trade, while Johnston and the other rebels maintained it was because he was an insufferable twat. In 1855, William Howitt, a rabid teetotaler who blamed all of the evils of the world on alcohol, drank Bligh's rum-spake Kool-Aid and renamed the Great Rebellion of 1808 the Rum Rebellion. The name stuck. The Rum Rebellion was a curiously laid-back affair, with the soldiers of the corps singing and playing musical instruments as they marched on Government House. The only armed resistance came in the small and determined form of Bligh's daughter, whose husband had succumbed to tuberculosis just days earlier. Shrieking with grief and fury, Mary assaulted the soldiers with her parasol. There is something quintessentially Australian about the 1808 revolution. The Americans have the midnight ride of Paul Revere and the Declaration of Independence. The French have the storming of the Bastille and the execution of a king. The Russians have Lenin, Trotsky, and 6 years of starvation, terror, and mass murder. We have a bit of a sing-along and a crazy chick with a small paper umbrella. When the soldiers of the corps entered Government House, Bligh was nowhere to be seen. And so began a 2-hour game of hide-and-seek, which ended, according to the rebels, when Bligh was found quivering under his bed. Bligh must have wished he'd brought a futon, because despite his protestations that he was just hiding his papers, he was mocked for cowardice for the rest of his life. George Johnston now ruled New South Wales, and Esther Abrahams, the one-time Jewish single mother-cum-lace thief, was the colony's first lady. The colonists celebrated Bligh's fall with an all-night party, burning effigies of the bastard, tucking into giant platters of freshly roasted sheep, and drinking vast quantities of rum. Some find it disturbing that these events took place on Australia Day, but celebrating the national holiday with fighting, disrespect for authority, a Barbie and a piss-up, you can't get more Australian than that. Chapter 8. I Still Call Australia New Holland. Australia. Matthew Flinders, 1804. Going Dutch. Pedants will point out that the Rum Rebellion couldn't have taken place on Australia Day because Australia was not yet Australia, but some other place called New Holland. The irritating thing about pedants is that they are almost always right. The Australian continent had been known as New Holland since the Dutch seafarer Abel Tasman popped over to complain about the lack of facilities in 1644. The Dutch were a direct people who called a spade a schoep and were not terribly inventive when it came to naming things. If they established a company to trade in the East Indies, they'd call it the Dutch East India Company. If they discovered a big island, they'd call it Groot Island, Big Island. When the Dutch got adventurous, they'd name their discoveries after bits of the Netherlands, and when they were really on fire, insert the word new, first. The Netherlands is small, which meant Dutch explorers gave the same names to lots of different places. They had christened their Brazilian territories New Holland in the 1630s, but Tasman, stuck for ideas, happily recycled the name a decade later. Tasman went on to discover New Zealand, which was named after the Dutch province of Zeeland, or the bit of New Guinea the Dutch had previously named New Zealand, or perhaps Zeelandia, which is what the Dutch called their settlement in Taiwan. According to accepted Dutch nomenclature, Australia and New Zealand should have been named New Holland and New Zealand. Still, the colonists should have been grateful that the continent no longer bore the pre-1644 Dutch name. Tasman had been dispatched to Australian waters to further Dutch knowledge of all the totally unknown provinces of beach, a name that reflected the Dutch assessment that the continent was covered in useless sand that no one would buy from them. At least the colonists could fall asleep at night, knowing they weren't known as Sons of Beach. The colonists wanted a new name for the land they inhabited, but coming up with something suitably clever and British was lower down their list of priorities than not starving, not being swept away by the deluges that regularly swept through the floodplains on which they had cleverly built their settlements, and not being speared or set alight by the locals. Still, a new name was definitely on the agenda. And it wasn't as if the Dutch could do anything about it. The Netherlands had been on the decline since the Great Tulip Collapse of 1637. The Dutch had lost New Holland, the Brazilian one, to the Portuguese in 1661, Zeelandia to the Chinese in 1662, and New Netherland and its capital, New Amsterdam, to the British in 1674. The British, who were really not much better at naming things than the Dutch, incorporated New Netherlands into New England and renamed New Amsterdam, New York. The French surprised everyone by overrunning the Netherlands in 1795, after having successfully conquered themselves in 1789. In 1789, the French finally found an enemy they were unable to run away from. This self-defeating experience was lauded by French existentialists. It was also welcomed by French absurdists, who were proud that the French Revolution started in an indoor tennis court with the swearing of the tennis court oath. The French still celebrate the French Revolution as their greatest military victory. With the winding up of the bankrupt Dutch East India Company in 1800, the Dutch were no longer able to go traipsing around the globe nailing kitchenware to posts, which, quite frankly, everybody else had grown pretty tired of. After they regained their independence from the French in 1813, the Dutch mostly stayed at home smoking funny cigarettes and producing pornography. The Dutch claim this is art, pointing out that Rubens started producing the critically acclaimed big and busty Homegirls of Holland series in the late 16th century. In 1804, with the Dutch safely under Napoleon's jackboot, an enterprising young sailor first called Australia Australia so that we can still call it home. His name was Matthew Flinders. It is not strictly true that Flinders was the first person to name the continent Australia. The name had previously been applied to the general South Pacific area, and the naturalists Sir James Smith and George Shaw referred to the vast island, or rather continent, of Australia, Australasia or New Holland in their 1793 Zoology and Botany of New Holland. Although running through a few names before settling on the Dutch one doesn't really count. Matt and his cat. Australia has more statues of Matthew Flinders than of any other man. It also has more statues of Matthew Flinders' cat Trim than of any other cat. Yet most Australians know little of the man who gave them their name, and even less of his fearless feline friend. Flinders ran away to sea at the age of 15 after reading Robinson Crusoe. He soon signed as a midshipman on the second breadfruit voyage, during which Bligh tutored him in navigation and swearing. In Tahiti, Flinders entertained the locals with his flute playing and, if his purchase of a large quantity of mercury from the ship's surgeon is anything to go by, caught a dose of the clap. Flinders travelled to New South Wales in 1795, shipping out on the same boat as the returning Bennelong and an aspiring young surgeon George Bass, who would go down in history as the first man to dissect a wombat. Bass and Flinders soon discovered a shared passion for boating and exploring and became something of a double act. Bass had bought his beloved Tom Thumb, a tiny 8-foot boat, to the colony and invited Flinders out sailing. The intrepid duo decided to re-explore Botany Bay and for their second expedition in Tom Thumb 2 to re-re-explore it before popping down the south coast for the weekend. Here they encountered a band of hostile Aborigines, but Flinders defused the situation by producing a pair of scissors and offering their would-be assailants free haircuts. Bass went sailing without Flinders in 1797 and explored the colony's southeastern coastline. His failure to run into Van Diemen's Land led him to speculate that it might be an island, and Governor Hunter gave now Lieutenant Flinders a bigger boat so that he could test this theory. Bass came along for the ride and dissected an echidna and some seals while Flinders mapped the coastline, confirming that a body of water separated Van Diemen's Land from the mainland. He named it Bass Strait. In 1799, Flinders sailed to the Cape of Good Hope. A kitten fell overboard during this voyage, but managed to swim back to the ship and scale a rope. Flinders, who had been afraid to get a pet while Bass was around, adopted the courageous kitty and named it Trim after the servant in Tristram Shandy, his second favourite book after Robinson Crusoe. Flinders and Trim travelled to England in 1801, where Flinders married Anne Chappell, a short older woman whom smallpox had blinded in one eye. The young mariner and his cat sailed back to New Holland 3 months after the wedding, with Flinders in command of his biggest boat yet, the Investigator. Sir Joseph Banks had sponsored the Investigator mission as part of a scientific arms race against the French. Although Britain and France were at war, both believed in science and issued passports to each other's Poindexters. In 1796, Banks arranged a British passport for Nicolas Baudin, allowing the French explorer and naturalist to collect specimens in the Caribbean. The British establishment laughed off Baudin's expedition, mainly because his ship was named the Fanny, but Banks was increasingly worried that Napoleon's crack eggheads were out-boffining Britons. The merde really hit Les Ventilateurs when Baudin was sent to survey the as yet unclaimed, except by Aborigines, southern and western coasts of New Holland. Flinders, equipped with un passeport français, sailed after Baudin with orders to chart this coastline too and conclusively settle whether it and New South Wales were part of the same continent. He encountered Baudin at South Australia's conveniently named Encounter Bay on 8 April 1802. While Flinders spoke limited French and Baudin refused to speak English because that's what French people do, the two seafarers got on well and wished each other luck. Flinders and Trim went on to become the first man and cat to circumnavigate Australia, while Baudin named southern Australia Terra Napoleon. Nobody except the French took this seriously, and Baudin abandoned his expedition in Sydney after scurvy killed a tenth of his crew and the ship's monkey. This is one of the earliest historical records of a surrender monkey. Flinders and Trim set sail for England, but only made it 700 miles before wrecking their ship on the inconveniently named Wreck Reef. After a miserable rowboat trip back to Sydney, Flinders and his plucky pussy again struck out for home, this time aboard the Cumberland. The ship had to put in at Mauritius for repairs, and Flinders, despite his French passport, was arrested. Charles Descartes, the island's French governor, accused Flinders of carrying military documents and claimed that the passport was invalid because it only authorised travel aboard the Investigator. These charges were mere pretexts. Descartes had arrested Flinders for the far more serious crime of bad manners. He was furious that Flinders had failed to remove his hat before addressing him and had refused an invitation to dine with Madame Descartes. The vindictive governor ignored Napoleon's order to release Flinders and kept him imprisoned for 7 years, during which time Trim mysteriously disappeared. Flinders offered a princely 10 guineas for the return of the missing Moggy, but eventually reconciled himself to the fact that his cat had been eaten by the French. In 1804, Flinders wrote to Banks, enclosing a map of the continent he had recently charted, labelled Australia. Banks hated the name because he was a botanist and botanists like double-barreled Latin names for things. He wanted to call the continent Terra Australis. Flinders was finally released in 1810 and returned to England a broken man. The French had claimed credit for his maps, he had little money, and he suffered from the gravelly, an agonising venereal legacy that left him peeing gravel-like crystals. He spent the next 4 years hiding from his wife in the attic, preparing his charts and manuscripts for publication. Banks had convinced him to call the book A Voyage to Terra Australis, although Flinders included a footnote. Had I permitted myself any innovation on the original term, it would have been to convert it to Australia. Bass Strait. Flinders wrote Bass a letter in 1800 that lay undiscovered until 1998. It contained the following lines. There was a time when I was so completely wrapped up in you that no conversation but yours could give me any degree of pleasure. Your footsteps on the quarterdeck over my head took me from my book and brought me upon deck to walk with you. And yet it is not clear to me that I love you entirely. At least my affection for Wilds reaches farther into my heart. I would take him into the same skin as me. This tender missive was never received by Bass, who had left his London home, like Flinders, after just 3 months of marriage, to drown off the South American coast. The letter was opened and read by the new Mrs. Bass, who scrawled a note to her husband on its envelope. This, George, is written by a man that bears a bad character. No one has seen this letter, but I could tell you many things that make me dislike him. The letter and the somewhat alarmed response of Mrs. Bass have led to speculation that Flinders, in the sailing vernacular of his age, puffed with the southerly wind. Yet many historians insist that Flinders' marriage and venereal disease prove that he was straight. Gay men clearly don't marry women or get the clap, and bisexuality doesn't even bear thinking about. They contend that the letter was an example of romantic friendship of the kind experienced by Shakespeare in his fair youth, diggers in the trenches of Gallipoli, none of whom could possibly have been gay, and Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. They would be prepared to reconsider their position if presented with sufficient historical proof to the contrary. For example, a portrait of Bass and Flinders in a hot tub signed by both explorers and witnessed by Governor Hunter. This sort of proof is hard to come by. Homosexual activity was not uncommon at the turn of the 19th century, particularly in the Royal Navy, but it was extremely dangerous for a young sailor to come out of Davy Jones's locker. Buggery was, in Flinders' day, the crime that dare not speak its name. Sir William Blackstone, England's greatest 18th century jurisprudist, and prudist generally, wrote in his commentaries on the laws of England,
"I will not act so disagreeable a part to my readers as well as myself as to dwell any longer upon a subject the very mention of which is a disgrace to human nature. It will be more eligible to imitate in this respect the delicacy of our English law, which treats it, in its very indictments, as a crime not fit to be named."
The death penalty for the unnameable crime was rigorously enforced in Britain until 1861 and until as late as 1887 in the Australian colonies, while those convicted of the lesser crimes of attempted no-namery or being a bit sus were punished with time in the pillory, similar to the stocks. This was often a de facto death sentence, as the mob would pelt them with any ready-to-hand heavy objects. Jeremy Bentham, the guy who devised disciplinary prisons and the wonderful whipping machine, wrote Offences Against Oneself in 1785. In it, Bentham argued that homosexuality, although involving irregularities of the venereal appetite, was essentially a private matter that didn't hurt anyone, and that Britons should therefore stop hanging gay people. However, this view was so radical that Bentham buried the essay in his sock drawer and it remained unpublished until 1931. The death of Viscount Castlereagh, the British Secretary of State for War in the colonies at the time of the Rum Rebellion, illustrates the difficulty of being a gay Georgian. In 1822, Castlereagh, then leader of the House of Commons, advised King George IV that he was being blackmailed for homosexual acts, confessing,
"I am accused of the same crime as the Bishop of Clogher."
The Bishop of Clogher, the suggestively named Percy Jocelyn, the cards were really stacked against him, was found with a naked Grenadier Guardsman in the back room of a Westminster pub earlier in 1822. He skipped bail, assumed the name Thomas Wilson, and went to work as a butler in Scotland, a land where a man might wear a skirt with pride. The King advised Castlereagh to consult a physician. Instead, Castlereagh returned to his estate and cut his throat with a letter opener. His funeral procession was jeered along its whole route. Lord Byron penned the following touching obituary to Castlereagh. "Posterity will ne'er survey a nobler grave than this. Here lie the bones of Castlereagh. Stop, traveller, and piss." So, were Bass and Flinders more than just good sailing buddies? There is certainly some circumstantial evidence that Flinders sailed counterclockwise. 1. Flinders was in the Royal Navy. 2. He chose to emigrate to a place with the world's highest male-female ratio and a flexible approach to issues of conventional morality. 3. He enjoyed intimate sailing trips and repeatedly exploring the same place with a fellow traveller. 4. He had a small animal companion. 5. He ran away from his wife as soon as was decently practicable. 6. He played the flute. 7. He was a hairdresser. 8. His favourite book was about a chap marooned on an island with only an obliging man Friday for company. 9. He never owned a boat called the Fanny. 10. His charting of Tasmania gave the Atlas its only pink triangle. But whether gay, straight or somewhere in between, Matthew Flinders sits atop the pantheon of true blue Aussie heroes. The passing of the baton. The 40-year-old Flinders, ravaged by the gravelly, lapsed into a coma and died on 19 July 1814, the day after his book was published. He didn't get to see his continent renamed, but on 12 December 1817, the Governor of New South Wales recommended that Britain adopt the name Australia. That governor's name was Lachlan Macquarie. Chapter 9. The Great Economiser.
Maritza's asma penny fee, and I am on guide at Canio.
My Nannio, Robert Burns, 1783. Ha ye a spare penny. Lachlan Macquarie was a Scotsman to his bootstraps, which he'd be proud to let you know he bought for an absolute bargain at an Edinburgh thrift store. He was cousin to the ancient chieftain of Clan Macquarie, nephew to the Laird of Lochbuy, and a proud son of Olver. Olver, a tiny windswept speck in the North Atlantic, was noted only for its kelp industry and, according to Dr. Samuel Johnson, for being the last place in Britain where the local lords still claimed the feudal right to bed a bride on her wedding night. Although Johnson acknowledged that old Macquarie was prepared to break with tradition if the groom gifted him a sheep. Sheep are highly valued in Scotland, as they are the principal ingredient of haggis, a hideous boiled sausage made from sheep offal and oatmeal encased in a sheep's stomach. This unspeakably vile concoction became the national dish of Scotland following the publication of Robert Burns's Address to a Haggis in 1787, but has since been supplanted by the deep-fried Mars bar. Most of the Ulvaks, as the natives of Ulva were known, aspired to nothing more than a good seaweed harvest and marriage to a cousin who had not been too badly scarred by the pox. The Ulvaks' passion for inbreeding may explain the forlorn and helpless situation of Donald Macquarie, Lachlan's idiot brother. But young Lachlan Macquarie had bigger dreams than his fellow islanders. He would restore the name and fortune of his once mighty clan. In 1746, 16 years before Lachlan's birth, the English had thrashed the Highland clans at the Battle of Culloden and stripped the Macquaries of most of their lands, their kilts and their sporrans. The sporran is a furry pouch that hangs at the front of a Scotsman's pocketless kilt. Scotsmen use their sporrans to store hip flasks, knuckle dusters and any small denomination coins they have not yet had the opportunity to bury in their backyards. The British Parliament passed a law in 1747 banning Highlanders from wearing kilts, sporrans and other traditional dress outside the British Army, with Scots dressing carrying a penalty of 7 years' transportation. This law was repealed in 1782 because the Americans refused to accept further deliveries of angry skirt-wearing rangers. 3 decades after Culloden, the 63-year-old clan's chief's finances were so dire that he was forced to join the British Army and travel across the Atlantic to fight Americans. 14-year-old Lachlan also enlisted and travelled to Canada, the United States and Jamaica without getting to fight anyone, which was a profound disappointment to him. Army wages were poor, and a soldier could only secure his fortune by looting the towns of the defeated foe. It was the spoils of war that attracted hordes of Scotsmen to join the British Army, as fighting and stealing were etched onto the DNA of every man born north of Hadrian's Wall. Macquarie was offered another opportunity to fight and steal from foreigners in 1787, this time in India. But first he had to buy a lieutenancy and pay 15 men to fight and steal under him. This would require him to go into debt, which was the worst four-letter word in his vocabulary. Macquarie, like most Scots, knew the value of a penny. His diaries record in excruciating detail the prices of goods purchased throughout his life. The thriftiness of Scots is well recognised in the commercial world. McFrugal is Scotland's most popular online hardware chain, while Scotch Tape received its name after a client of the 3M company criticised the lack of adhesive in the middle of the tape and told a salesman to take the product back to his Scotch bosses. 3M embraced the Scotch name because economising was regarded as a virtue during the Great Depression era in which the tape was invented. Macquarie, however, calculated that the gold and gems he would liberate from the recalcitrant Maharajas of the Orient would prove his commission a canny investment. And so we find the 25-year-old Macquarie striding through the misty highlands in search of 15 brave and reasonably priced countrymen prepared to join him in the heat and dust of India. Hayi a spare rupee. Bombay proved a disappointment. Macquarie had been there for 3 years and hadn't been allowed to fight or steal from anyone. He finally got his chance in 1791 against Tipu Sayyid, the Sultan of Mysore. During the campaign, Macquarie took to the field with 6 bullocks, 10 servants, 8 dozen bottles of brandy and Madeira, and
a quantity of gin.
This was travelling light by Indian Army standards. Some officers campaigned with over 40 servants. The overburdened soldiers were soon bogged down in monsoonal rains and bombarded by the iron-cased rockets recently invented by the Mysoreans. By the time they reached Tipu's stronghold, they were so wet and shell-shocked that they retreated without firing a shot. Macquarie was laid low with dysentery and malaria, and Indians looted most of his possessions on the long journey back to barracks. War had not lived up to expectations. Having failed to make his fortune through military endeavour, Macquarie threw himself into Bombay's social circuit of balls and music parties and fell in love with Miss Jane Jarvis and her inheritance. Jane was the daughter of a Jamaican plantation owner and, like many young women of sufficient means and insufficient breeding, had travelled to India in the hope of securing a suitable boy from among the ranks of Britain's most eligible looters. Macquarie was determined to impress Jane with his discipline, which one of his diary entries defined as getting dressed by 2:30 in the afternoon, drinking no more than 12 glasses of wine and 1 strong beer a night, and only consuming malt liquor during daylight hours. Macquarie and Jane married, but only after Macquarie signed a legal agreement confirming that he would not make use of her money. He soon found matrimony an uneconomic proposition. He had to buy new china and linen, decorated fans, parasols, songbirds, picnic baskets, embroidery patterns, pianoforte sheet music, smelling salts and other feminine necessities. Married officers were also expected to invite the single chaps around for Friday drinks. After one such session, Macquarie's shaky diary entry read,
"No beer for 3 months."
Macquarie, who was spending 800 rupees for every 500 he earned, soon fell out with his in-laws over
a misunderstanding,
which was Macquarie's speak for being caught trying to draw down on Jane's inheritance. The grafting Highlander found the answer to his financial problems when he was appointed regimental paymaster. He arranged to receive the funds for the regiment's wages before his men were due to be paid and invested it for his own benefit. He also attempted to rebuild the fortunes of the Macquarie clan by sponsoring fake army commissions and getting relatives as young as 5 to change their names to match those of the fictional officers. This enabled his kinsmen to draw military pay while happily harvesting seaweed thousands of miles from the nearest battlefield. Macquarie's career was progressing nicely. He'd led the British Army into the Dutch settlement of Cochin and kicked the tulip growers out of Ceylon. He was devastated by his wife's death in 1796, but the cloud of her passing had a sterling silver lining, a £6,000 inheritance. Macquarie was now posted to fight Napoleon in Egypt. The campaign was almost over when he arrived, but he stayed long enough to learn to ride a camel and contract syphilis. He returned to Britain in 1803 with the rank of Major, a fortune of £20,000, and George Jarvis, an Indian slave boy he had purchased for 85 rupees and given a new name for free. George would stay by Macquarie's side for the rest of his life. Macquarie hoped never to see a samosa again. He would return to the sweet haggis of his youth, haggle over the price of a modest estate on the Isle of Mull, and spend the remainder of his days burying his money on its grounds. But reality and the taxman would intrude to shatter this Highland ideal. An economy with the truth. Within months of his return, Macquarie was forced to part with 12 guineas for an operation
of a very delicate nature.
The Cairo clap was playing havoc with his waterworks, and Macquarie required ongoing treatment, which involved periodically dipping the affected region into a dish of liquid mercury. This highly toxic metal remained the principal treatment for syphilis until the invention of antibiotics, giving rise to the saying, "One night with Venus and a lifetime with mercury." Mercury treatment for venereal disease commonly resulted in tooth loss, skin lesions, spongy bones, neurological damage and/or dropping dead from mercury poisoning. Macquarie was also having trouble with tax, in that he was being asked to pay it. He successfully claimed that £3,000 worth of shares he owned were the property of his brother and that £1,000 found in his house belonged to an unusually wealthy servant. Macquarie was emboldened by these victories over the taxman. Macquarie literally got off scot-free. The scot was a 13th century tax levied to support the poor, and the term scot-free was used to describe successful tax evasion. But Macquarie embarked on one fraud too many. He lobbied for the
wonderfully stout and active
old Macquarie to be commissioned an officer of the Horse Guards. He proposed that the sprightly chieftain, just a few months shy of his 90th birthday, be given full pay while being granted permanent leave from sitting on a horse or guarding anything. This arrangement was so unusual that it was drawn to the attention of the Duke of York, the British Army's Commander-in-Chief. After a bit of digging, the Duke found he had also been paying the Horse Guard salaries of two of Macquarie's prepubescent kinsmen. His Royal Highness Prince Frederick was the grand old Duke of York of nursery rhyme fame. He had 10,000 men and two small Scottish boys. The Duke demanded that Macquarie produce these mysterious officers who had never turned up for duty. Macquarie regretfully declined on the grounds that they had just sailed for Jamaica to manage a sugar plantation. The Duke suggested Macquarie was being economical with the truth, and Macquarie finally admitted that the officers were attending a primary school just down the road. With breathtaking audacity, he then asked the Duke to keep them on full pay while they completed their schooling. The furious Duke kicked the boys out of the army and punished Macquarie by booking him another passage to India. On the night before he left, Macquarie performed the traditional Ulvark ritual of asking for his cousin's hand in marriage. Elizabeth Campbell, Macquarie's second cousin once removed and sister to his aunt by marriage, was a sensible girl with a keen interest in gardening and architecture. Her practical nature appealed to Macquarie. Although he initially felt no passion for her, he was satisfied he'd found a companion who could keep house and, with any luck, mow his lawn and build him a gazebo. Sadly, the only fighting Macquarie saw during the following 2 years in India was with the army's paymaster, who objected to meeting his extravagant liquor bills. He married Elizabeth upon his return and took command of the Black Watch, a regiment of Scotland's most vicious and bloodthirsty looters. The watch was to travel to New South Wales to replace the disgraced Rum Corps, and an army man was to be appointed governor, given the colony's previous naval rulers had failed to command the loyalty of their troops. The governorship was given to Major General Miles Nightingale, who immediately developed a mysterious arthritis of the wrist that prevented him from travelling. Nightingale sat around for months until he was told he didn't have to sail for Sydney if he didn't want to, at which time his wrist miraculously recovered and accepted a posting more to its liking in Spain. Macquarie wrote to Lord Castlereagh, the colonial secretary, suggesting that his wrist was up to governing New South Wales. Much to everybody's surprise, Castlereagh gave him the job. Macquarie was an unusual choice. At 47, he was the oldest lieutenant colonel in the army. He'd been caught arranging dodgy commissions and lying to the royal family. He was in poor health, with his skin yellowed from malaria and a liver that had spent decades being kicked by Johnny Walker. His face and limbs were blotched from the curative acids he applied to his syphilitic lesions, and years of bathing, "Wee Mr. Muck," in mercury had left him with a disconcerting neurological twitch. Macquarie was appointed because most competent men of rank didn't want to live with habitual criminals, mutinous soldiers, and naked savages in a far-flung land that had destroyed the career of every governor since Philip. And Britannia had her hands full with Frenchmen who'd learned to fight and Americans who'd decided they wanted to own Canada after all. New South Wales was nothing more than the echo of an afterthought in the distracted mind of Mother Britain. Mopping up, spilt rum. Macquarie was sworn in on 1 January 1810, a new governor for a new decade. He had orders to restore Bligh as governor for a day and then send him packing. But the bastard was nowhere to be found. Bligh, who'd been released after promising to return to England, had instead seized the ship that was to take him home and sailed for Van Diemen's Land, demanding that the Vandemonians invade New South Wales on his behalf. The Vandemonians were having none of it, and Bligh offended Lieutenant Governor David Collins by making snide comments about his pregnant convict mistress. Collins said of his unwelcome guest, "God knows I never had any malice in my heart until I came into contact with this detestable brute." Bligh returned to his ship in a sulk and spent the next 6 months blockading Hobart. Collins ordered his people to fire on the deranged ex-governor if he attempted landfall. Bligh ran out of supplies and once again found himself starving at sea. He survived by letting ships through his blockade if their captains gave him a biscuit. Back in Sydney, Macquarie told the remaining rebels that they'd been very naughty and asked them not to rebel again. George Johnson had returned to Britain to be court-martialed for treason, and MacArthur had also fled New South Wales following a duel with Lieutenant Colonel Faveau, the officer tasked with restoring order after the rebellion. As a gesture of reconciliation, the new governor dug deep into the Australian zeitgeist, unearthing a powerful mortar to bind the fractious colonists together. Sport. Macquarie noticed that settlers and convicts gathered together on Sydney Street to enjoy horse races, weighted foot races, fistfights, dogfights, cockfights, and any other sort of fight. Weighted foot racing was a popular spectator sport. William Francis King, known as the Flying Pieman, was Australia's greatest ever weight racer. He made a living betting on himself in races against other competitors or in outlandish challenges against the clock, sometimes demanding that he be horsewhipped to maximise his performance. He walked from Campbelltown to Sydney in 9 hours carrying a 32-kilogram dog and from Sydney to Parramatta in 7 hours carrying a 36-kilogram goat. He later ran a mile, walked a mile, pushed a wheelbarrow half a mile, dragged a fat lady in a carriage a half mile, walked backwards for a half mile, and leapt over 50 stones set a yard apart, all in less than 90 minutes. King's feats of endurance became so well known that nobody was prepared to bet against him. Deprived of his income and clearly as mad as a cut snake, he died penniless in Liverpool Asylum. So, like the emperors of ancient Rome with whom his critics later compared him, Macquarie cemented his rule with bread and circuses. He set aside a section of the commons for the recreational amusement of the inhabitants of the town and named it Hyde Park, holding Australia's first officially sanctioned horse races there 2 days later. The 1810 racing carnival lasted 3 days and the whole town came out to gamble, drink and fight. Macquarie soon held another fair at which ladies raced in sacks for cheese and gentlemen came to bet on them and have a good laugh. Macquarie's attempts to reconcile the colony's hostile factions were temporarily derailed when Bligh and his daughter returned. The crowd would hoot and jeer at the ex-governor as he scuttled to Government House to present his increasingly shrill demands that Macquarie exact vengeance on those who had brought him down. For 4 months, Macquarie politely ignored Bligh's tantrums, reporting to his non-idiot brother Charles,
"He certainly is a most disagreeable person to have any dealings or public business to transact with. He is a very improper person to be employed in any situation of trust or command, and he is certainly generally detested by high, low, rich and poor."
Mary, who had spent the last 2 years locked up in Government House and starving off the coast of Tasmania, hastily married the colony's new Lieutenant Governor, Maurice O'Connell.